All right. Well, welcome everyone back to the Stanford AI and Healthcare podcast. Yet another episode for the new year. We're absolutely thrilled to have Dr. Bob Wachter with us today. Many of you already know him from his other roles, including the chair of medicine at UCSF. He's also written two books. The first, of course, is one that a lot of us studied in med school called The Digital Doctor, helping us understand the digital transformation that we all went through in our formative years in the 2000s, and now a new book that he's released called A Giant Leap, which we'll get into today because it's so topical and really walks us through how AI has transformed healthcare and all the missteps along the way to get to the point where we are today. Fun fact about Bob, who I happen to have a lot in common with, including that we were both liberal arts majors, but I learned this recently, Bob. Is it true that you were the mascot, the Penn Quaker for the University of Pennsylvania? And if so, you have to spend just a minute on
Well,
that story.
thank you, Matt. Not only true, but I am the answer to a great trivia question. If you're ever playing Trivial Pursuit and need something, who was the mascot of the last Ivy League team to go to the Final Four in basketball? And the answer is me. And so I was the mascot of the University of Pennsylvania in 1979. That'll show you how old I am. There'd been one prior Ivy team to go to the Final Four, Princeton's Bill Bradley's team. About 15 years earlier. And we ended up beating Syracuse, Iona, St. John's, and then UNC. And the media went crazy, like, oh, these Ivy League eggheads going to the Final Four. And we actually drank the Kool-Aid. It was like, oh my God, we're going to win the Final Four. We go out to Salt Lake City and we play this team with this guy named Magic Johnson on it. And when we fell behind, I think 45-7, it was pretty clear we were not going to win the Final Four. But yes, the pictures sadly are still on the web. If you want us to just look up my last name, Wachter and Quaker, it's me wearing a three-corner hat, bifocals, knickers. I think I look pretty damn good, and a red top coat and a ruffled white shirt. It's really quite something.
Well, pulling that off might be one of your greatest crowning achievements then.
I think if you can do that, you're pretty much prepped for anything. You can be chair of a major department. It's not that hard.
100%. Well, again, thank you for joining us. And as you know, like on this show, we try to kick it off just trying to level set with the audience. We do this every month, spending just a couple minutes on where we are because things are changing so incredibly fast, just generally. I don't know if Justin, you have a couple graphics to show. Just to kind of get us oriented. But here we are again, another month, and we're having these conversations about who's in first. There's all these different sort of, breathless takes going around the internet. Obviously, there's a lot of investment dollars at stake here. Where's the most powerful technology? Who's using it? And who has the most market share, right? These are the discussions that come up a lot. And we're hearing a lot about constraints on supply chain, and we won't get into a lot of that, but it's coming down to literally the ability to capture and utilize electricity, right, which has lots of other implications, including geopolitical. But this kind of graphic is a comical look at the cyclical nature, because I think if you go back through the last few months or even the last year of our discussions, it's always been, well, so and so released a new model and now there looks like they're beating the leaderboards, et cetera. I think that it becomes kind of lost in the sort of broader noise at this point. I think some would argue, as we sort of been talking about before, when it comes to sort of the enterprise, the developer sort of personas, that the Anthropic models are certainly the favorite. But I don't know, Bob, if you're playing around with these models, I'm guessing you are. Are you getting into the point where you're quote unquote vibe coding? Have you like really tried to push the limits beyond some of just the sort of the medical and informational capabilities of the model? Have you really thought about, hey, I can maybe build an app for drug interaction or whatever, just seeing if it's possible to literally use English to create something. And we've been hearing these experiences from different folks. I'm curious to hear your take on that.
Yeah, I do not consider myself a technologist, and so and I think in some ways that's proven to be an advantage when I've tried to write and think about it, because I really approach it almost as an outsider and a journalist. And I think sometimes the people that are too in embedded in the technology sometimes lose a little bit of forest and trees. So the short answer is not much. I've done a couple of things where I just wrote mini code for myself with Claude. And then spoke to my son about it, and he said, "Dad, you can actually do that on Excel. And you didn't need to do that." So, I felt all proud of myself. But I would say that slide is sort of misleading when it comes to healthcare. because if it was healthcare, I would have a big circle in the middle called Epic. And I think, a lot of the public debate, quite understandably, is, which among these titans is going to win the battle to be the, AI dominant AI player in the world. That's obviously a crucial battle. I don't know how whether that is the same battle. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's not, as to who's going to win the battle for the 20% of the GDP that's healthcare. And I'm guessing there are going to be multiple winners because it's a big slice and there are different elements of it, and there's consumer facing and institutional facing. But when I hear all this talk about are we at superintelligence or not superintelligence, it's like I don't really care. I actually don't think that's going to be decisive about as to whether this has a huge impact in healthcare or not. In terms of the tools I use, I'm shifting the way everybody else is, I think. I tended to use GPT for most everything. And but the new Gemini is so great, I tend to use it. And I certainly use it when I'm doing pictures and videos and when I'm doing writing. And I sort of want a charming personality, I tend to use Claude for that. So those are the three that I kind of tie. And I use OpenEvidence for a lot for clinical insights, which I think is quite good.
So it's interesting. You've already brought up Epic, right? The big player in the room. We had Seth Haine on a few months back, kind of talking through different pieces there. We've also, started the new year, lots of announcements. There was a Claude for healthcare, a ChatGPT for healthcare, OpenEvidence raising more money, trying to do medical super intelligence. It's like, how do you put all these announcements in frame for kind of what matters as you think about using your chair hat or your kind of individual provider hat? Is it still all about Epic, or what do all these announcements mean?
I don't think it's all about Epic, but I think that one of the great questions in healthcare is the electronic health record scaffolding for all of the work? And I think, and I say all the work, 10 years ago, I would have said the professional work, meaning the work the doctors and nurses, and today you would say, and also the what patients need because of their patient portal. And if the answer turns out to be yes, then Epic just has a massive incumbency advantage. All of these other organizations and tools, they're trying to become the platform of choice. But there's already a platform that you're working on. And so they have to overcome that advantage. And Epic, I have to say, is pretty damn good. I mean, I think it could have been easy to sit here in Silicon Valley and be skeptical that a company built on a farm in, outside of Madison is going to be able to do the AI thing. They did the EHR thing pretty well, but are they going to be able to do the AI thing, or are they going to be dabbling, not have the competencies, not be able to recruit the kinds of people they need? And so they'll be supplanted. And eventually, maybe you still have Epic as your core tool, but it's going to be a Christmas tree on which there's going to be lots of ornaments. And I think if you look at them for the last 3 or 4 years, they have put out generally good, generally useful tools that are probably not going to be as good as the cutting edge tool of the third party VC funded vendor puts out. But I think if you're a UCSF and you're choosing, that third party tool better be a hell of a lot better and probably also cheaper than the Epic tool, because the Epic tool, we just have to, press a button and it's on, and we're confident Epic's going to be in business in 5 years, and we're not confident that a startup is. So I think that's a great thing in a way. It's nice to have a big unified tool that works. It's a terrible thing in a way if you believe that innovation is thwarted by monopolies. But every time I think no, it's a bad thing, we need an ecosystem that's more vibrant. And if all these third-party companies die out, that's awful. And then look at the people who live their life in Google world, and use Gmail and Google Docs and Google this and Google that, and it's pretty good. And why do they do it? You could argue it's an unfair business advantage, but mostly they do it because it works and it's all integrated. So I sort of see Epic as the Google of our world. And because of the patient portal, we're not really just talking about professional use anymore. So I guess the final thing I'd say, Justin, is that right now we have the electronic health record and patients have their patient portal. And then you have, and it has all of the information about you. Maybe it misses a few social determinants, but by and large, it knows everything about your medical history. The idea that 2 years from now, we're all going to be taking that data and porting it out to some other place so that it can live in OpenAI world or, live in Apple world or live some, so that I can then ask it a question. Or do what I do when I'm in the wards, which is pick up my phone and say to OpenEvidence, I have a patient who's 82 years old who has CLL, who comes with a fever and a white count of creatinine of 3. What do you think? I mean, all of that's going to seem silly. All of that has to be integrated into the electronic health record, which already has all this data. So I think that, and who does that? I don't know. I was talking to Epic this morning about, are you doing that? Are you going to partner with somebody? And as usual, they were kind of cryptic about it. But that has to be the final goal here, because otherwise, it's just too fragmented.
Yeah, I would say, as we started drifting to the both, there's almost this branch point. I think we've talked about both a little bit already, but the idea of the consumer, right, which again you touch on in your book, made a very important point in your book. I think that's worth kind of teasing out here, which is the human in the loop that we always assumed would be using these AI technologies as the physician. But you make a strong argument, and this is something we've talked about a lot on this podcast, that maybe the human in the loop is actually the patient. And does that upend, we've kind of talked about the pressures of the access to this kind of intelligence that is increasingly better in healthcare right at the fingertips of, our patients everywhere, and how that's kind of changing the dynamic a bit with the health systems and the traditional, rhythms of care. But you make a strong point, like what's wrong with having, right, that human in the loop be the patient, right? And kind of being able to pull this together. And we're kind of seeing the evidence of this. I mean, Justin, you have the slide up now, but just the number of people leveraging GPT or other LLMs for their health queries or the things that they care about. And then now this is a really interesting graphic that's worth looking at here to even further drive home the point. Someone did a bit of an analysis on what you would call a care desert, or a place in the country where you're more than 30 minutes from a nearest health system. And they map that with the quantity of queries for health-related reasons in GPT. And you can see it's a pretty interesting overlap, right? Places that have very low access to care are leveraging, these consumer applications for healthcare-related queries. It kind of maybe speaks to the demand, and maybe it speaks to the empowerment. What's your take on these kinds of things? And are you seeing patients, I'm sure you are, that are coming in with, having had hours-long conversations, right, with the models? And what does that change in the dynamic for
Yeah,
your
of course,
practice?
and also recognize it's happening at a time where there's lots of skepticism about professional expertise and knowledge and institutions. And so the democratization of care, which I think was inevitable over time, gets even turbocharged when people don't trust doctors or nurses or hospitals or health systems. And I have to say that graph is really fascinating. But I wouldn't call San Francisco or Palo Alto a care desert by any means. But try to find a primary care doctor. I mean, not that easy. And I know at Stanford's been true. It's been true at UCSF as well, where it might be months before you get into a primary care appointment. The patient use of mental health chatbots, which of course we've seen some of the problems with it. But again, try to find a psychiatrist or psychologist, and even in places that are well positioned, like the Bay Area. And if you can, try to find one less than $300 or $400 an hour. So the idea that these tools now are providing patients insights, information that they think is useful, and mostly is useful, I think is net really good. But, Peter Lee made this point to me when I spoke to him for the book, and it was really, I hadn't really thought it through quite as much as the way Peter articulated. I think professionals sometimes forget how much they have learned. It's quite subtle. And so when you or I pick up GPT or Gemini or whatever and put in a query of the kind that I just did, that is a massively complex cognitive act of taking 100 different facts and saying, this is a 64-year-old person who comes with a fever and a shortness of breath and has a white count and has a blah, blah. Patients can't do that. You're really talking about the difference between experts and novices. And then the point you make, Matt, is that we're going to be in this world for the foreseeable future where AI is going to be useful enough and correct enough to be very useful, but not perfect. So the safety system will be a human in the loop. If the human in the loop is you, any of the three of us, I'm fine with it. But if the safety system is my mother is the human in the loop, I mean, her ability to determine that this response is really good and thoughtful, and this response is craziness, and I'm going to ignore that, she can't do that. So I think the tools that we build and deploy for consumer and patient-facing use have to be different and I think more doctor-like than the tools right now. I think, for a patient picking up GPT and using it, I think it's probably better than nothing. But I think the ultimate tool will be one that acts much more like a doctor, where the patient has a complaint and the AI says, "Well, tell me more about your headache and are your eyes hurting and is your neck stiff?" And I think we're starting to see some of those tools emerge, but I think until we have those, it's a little bit hazardous for patients using these tools by themselves. And the last thing I'd say is Jeff Fowler, who's the digital reporter for Washington Post, did a story with me a couple of months ago where he gave me 12 GPT prompts from patients and then the GPT responses. And some of them were outstanding, and one or two of them were downright dangerous. And I think, again, for a patient to be able to figure out which is asking a lot of lay people.
I think the other interesting thing you mentioned is just that trust component in physicians, kind of at an all-time low across the country. Actually, Graham Walker, who I think you've spoke with recently, we've had him on here as well, in the ED, wrote recently that he couldn't overcome the trust that the patient had with the chatbot. And despite trying to kind of talk through it, they had spent so long with the chatbot, paraphrasing, that he couldn't overcome the trust that, like, no, like, actually, it's wrong. He's an AI-focused doctor. He knows these tools.
That's
But
funny.
it's just this fascinating piece now. It's not just, did I look it up before? It's, can you even overcome that barrier
Well,
when
I
you're building
completely
a
get
profile?
that because when I'm thinking of a diagnosis and I check it on GPT and it comes up with the answer, it's like, yeah, I'm right. It's like I've been doing this for 40 years and I'm trusting this thing in my phone. Like it's kind of crazy. But actually, Graham told me an amazing story. I don't know if he told you that when he lives on a street that's got a big hill in San Francisco and it's kind of dangerous and there have been a bunch of pedestrian accidents. And if he's crossing the street and not paying attention, he looks up. And he sees a regular car, he's actually scared and he'll scamper across the street. If he sees it's a Waymo, he feels perfectly confident that nothing's gonna happen. And that's a perfectly rational response. So the idea that patients are gonna give these things trust, it's gonna happen. Whether it's undue trust, I think is really the devil's gonna be in the details. But, and it is a worry because I think it is so human-like and there is so much mistrust in institutions and in professionals. That I think they may give it undue trust while, in the short term.
If we kind of go through like the landscape of things that you talk about this in your book, kind of the history of all of these false, I don't want to call them totally false starts, but the sepsis challenges, right? Quote unquote AI in healthcare that was adopted at a
Sure.
larger scale. We really are like kind of boiling this down to right now, at least digital scribes, open evidence are probably the two that I would probably say is sufficiently massively adopted to, for folks to say, I've probably got this in my institution. Now, the question, though, I think that everyone wants to know is, I think you kind of get to this a little bit. Does this all just kind of drift towards commodity, right? Like, so, like, what? Where's the line between feature and product? And kind of tying back to the discussion around Epic, does Epic just sort of sit back as the system of record and say, listen, that seems to be getting some traction and have some value. Let's turn that into a feature on our product. The converse part of that, I think, is kind of what's happening with, as you're seeing in the markets right now, which is that, there's this bear case against SaaS that there's a lot of ink being spilled about this, but it does have corollary to Epic to me, which is that if I just use the LLM, I abstract away all of the other tools that we've paid seat licenses for and had 80% margins on for 20 years. That's a real existential threat to anyone who's a software vendor. Is there almost a twin sort of battle going on, and how do you think this will play out in healthcare if you have a thought around it? It's fascinating to me because, again, how hard would it be to incorporate an open evidence type model into a EMR? Probably not that hard, right?
Yeah, no,
But
not at all. Not at all.
and on the other side, could I use a sufficiently capable model on top of all of my software to say, hey, just do this thing. I don't care which software you use. I feel like we're a fork in the road almost on this right
I
now.
think a lot of these questions will be just empirically determined by each of the stakeholders making rational choices that they see as being in their own interest. Whether those choices get influenced by changes in the regulatory environment, changes in the payment environment, certainly in your world in radiology, One of the obstacles has been everybody waiting. Are they going to pay for AI-enabled mammograms or, whatever your favorite tool is? I think for the rest of us, I doubt the payment system is going to change very much, and that they're going to start paying, because and it's at some point it gets silly. It's like, you're going to buy a car, and do you have to pay extra for the AI-enabled windshield wipers and the AI-enabled steering wheel? It's like, no, that's what a car
For
costs
Tesla,
today.
yes.
And
For Tesla,
right,
yes.
for Tesla, you do. I don't have a Tesla, so I couldn't tell you. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a very dynamic market. I think in some ways, the mega question in healthcare is a different question than the OpenAI versus Gemini versus Anthropic question. It really is Epic as the core incumbent system of record versus allowing, whether it's a small startup doing a specific use case or a Google or a Microsoft in. I think that to me, that's where the battle will play itself out. And I'm kind of agnostic about who wins that. I mean, if Epic, I mean, nobody likes a monopoly, but if Epic figures out a way to continue to build tools that people find useful, and they're the path of least resistance, it's probably okay. I mean, now for UCSF and a Stanford, I think it becomes a little tricky, because if we're all using the same commoditized tool, and they're all B plus tools, and they're fine. We're going to need to think that through and figure out, like, how do we innovate? How do we test new things where there is not a model available? The tool that I might be using as a clinician might be different than the tool that we might want to build for a researcher who's looking for mechanisms. I think there's a lot of nuance around that. But in terms of the business battles, I think in some ways the stage is, I think a lot of the battles will happen in the consumer-facing world, where it sort of has its own dynamic. But in the professional enterprise world, I sort of see it Epic versus everybody else. And at the end of the day, nobody is, I mean, one other thing is clear for the startups. Nobody is buying 50 different point solutions. And nobody should buy 50 different points. That's a mess. So if you, 2 years ago, you were a Bridge or Ambience or Suki or any of these companies, and you built this, wow, I can't believe we built this incredible tool that does scribing. I feel sorry for them, because, like, now you're dead if that's all you do is scribing. That was camel's nose kind of stuff. You go, all right, got you in, bought you some hearts and minds of the docs, which is really important. You better come up with five other things that your tool does, because at the end of the day, UCSF and Stanford, we might have room for Epic tools, and then maybe three other companies. I'm not talking about, you're probably going to use a whole different suite of tools in radiology, and we'll probably use a bunch in surgery. I'm talking about sort of for general use, the way we do our work. There's probably one set of tools that's doing workflow, back office, scheduling, all that kind of, probably another set of tools that's clinical facing and decision support, and maybe one other, but there aren't going to be 20 of them. So that's the battle. Do any of those tools win? If they do, it's going to have to be a platform that solves a whole lot of different problems, not simply one.
This is the conversation, Bob, I have with hospital leaders across the country. Now, this exact same question, and it's really interesting because the default today is everyone buying one thing at a time. Ambient documentation, RCM, scheduling. But this thesis you mentioned of, hey, it makes no sense from a cost, integration, use, security, risk posture. And I expect this to kind of shake out this year.
And why do you think they're just fearful, and they're really putting toes in water? Is that why they're doing that?
Again, most of the cost is on the integration side, right? If you look like where to, for every request, that you implement at UCSF, there's probably 100 requests that are in backlog that never get done, that just get lodged in. Most of these are for the same sets of data and access and tooling that needs to get shown to people. And you do it each time for a net new point solution. And so it just doesn't make any sense from your own time allocation resource. And then for the people needing to use these tools, hey, we're going to go to 10 different places. And this is why Epic is so powerful. It is the one tool for the workflow. And so that I think will come as kind of an emerging opinion for, wait a second, there's going to be a huge consolidation, at least on the enterprise side for what this looks like.
Yeah, no, I think that sounds right. Why are they doing one tool at a time? Because they're all scared. They're scared of getting it wrong. Each one requires 37 different approvals, with any one of those 37 can kibosh it. So they're doing, and I have to say that at least as I look at the landscape over the last 2 or 3 years, I think we're going at it pretty smartly. And by that I mean you don't want to reach for the stars too early and then screw up and kill somebody, and that becomes the end of the whole thing. And so the idea that we really are dipping toes in water, let's start with scribes, let's be sure it's okay, let's see if we can get the buy-in from the docs. And they like it, good. Let's turn on this chart summarization tool or discharge summary drafting, or now maybe let's do a prior auth thing. And then before you know it, you're in platform world. It's like, all right, we got five different tools, five different companies. That's crazy. Can we consolidate this into one thing? But I'd rather do that and build on a foundation of success and buy-in and winning hearts and minds than basically what happened 40 years ago, which is they all started with diagnosis and the most ambitious use case, and it screwed up, and people said, oh, this is not ready for prime time, and the field went dead for 40 years. It's still possible. I mean, I don't think we're so far along here that the field will be impervious to what is inevitably going to be a high-profile failure that becomes a huge media story. And look, I told you. And the look I told yous will partly be from doctors, partly because they're worried about their patients, and partly because they're worried about their jobs. So I think it's important to take this pretty slow, and that's why there's sort of this one-off thing is in some ways counterproductive, but I understand where it's coming from.
It's this balance, right? Because like it does feel like I guess, I was sort of, certainly a part of the quote unquote prior wave of AI, right? Where we're sort of building these narrow point solutions where, but the technology wasn't, exponentially improving under our noses. And we were sort of able to kind of, in some ways, kind of direct and shape and shift it a bit. But it does seem like without those turns at bat, I almost feel like that divergence between the power users, like we see this in the ambient data too. Like you see these studies where like there's a health system that's implemented. I don't know how it is at your shop, but it's actually a fairly small percentage of the broader potential users that are power users, right? They're using the tool like, all the time. And then there's some sprinkling and it kind of trails off pretty quickly. And it almost feels like that group is learning, getting the understanding of the feel of, where it goes right, where it goes wrong, all that stuff. And they're seeing it in real time. Whereas the others are just sort of like, listen, maybe I checked in on 3.5 when it first came out. I don't, all this generative AI stuff is all hype, and it almost feels like you lose the audience if you don't, I don't know, give them the opportunity to have more experimentation.
I mean, I think that's right. But, as recognized as you do, that while people are tiptoeing into this in the enterprise world, and I'll try a scribe, and maybe I'll try the chart summary. Meanwhile, they're all using OpenEvidence, and they're all, they've all replaced their normal Google searches with a GPT or a Gemini search. So, and they're all, flabbergasted that it told them, what their exercise regimen should be or how to bake a pumpkin pie tonight. I mean, so there's a people are getting used to these tools and their magic in the rest of their life, and they're being understandably skeptical and going kind of slow in the professional world. I'd almost rather see that than the opposite. I think if we go headlong into this, it's hard to then disentangle that with just overhyping it, overpromising. And at the end of the day, what these tools can deliver is partly around how magical they are technologically, but in part, in some ways, why I'm a good person to have written this book, and it being that I don't really understand the technology, I don't think the technology is the determinative factor here. I think really it is this technology meets this unbelievably complex mess of a system where you have to really understand motivations and payment and stakeholders and insurers and prior auth and all this other crap. That's, so we got to take it slow-ish. Anytime this feels like we're going too slowly at it, just remember, I mean, GPT came out 3 years ago. The average time from a new advance in healthcare being implemented is 17 years. So
Totally.
this is rocket pace for us. And I think it's important that we build on a pretty solid foundation. And the people that are skeptical, I think there were people like that with electronic health records. Eventually, they had to either retire or learn how to use an EHR. I think the same thing's going to happen here. That right now you have early adopters trying it, you have early adopter systems trying it and being a little bit more aggressive about it. But at some point, this becomes the way we do our work. And I don't care if you're a slow adopter, it's time, or you cannot practice medicine anymore. This is the tool.
Well, the one big advantage on this set of tools versus the EHR, because there's a lot to look at for kind of those technical shifts, is not everyone has to use the tool today, like the scribe, to Matt's point. It's there for everyone, or usually not everyone, because it's a set number of licenses, but it's there if you want it and you want to make it. But not everyone has to use it. The EHR was this binary shift. Hey, we're all on, and you have to get that one, let's pick on it, surgeon who didn't want to adopt, who was super powerful and didn't want to go. These tools can now be made available if people can use them or not. And then performance and RVUs and all of those incentives will just start to push people towards adoption, if assuming the tools work and people find value versus before on this big flip. And the other thing that's just fascinating about the EMR landscape is when EMRs popped out early, this was before Epic kind of dominated the market, each department would have its own. There were all these smatterings of different EHRs. You couldn't connect one data to another. Everyone bought their own, was a total mess. And then it led to consolidation. That took much longer, right? It was a different pace of technology, a different set amount of time. But to me, that's the analogy, Bob, you brought up before, which is we're gonna have a consolidation from all these kind of different things that were bought now, just like we saw it before.
Yeah, well, Matt went back 50 years of my life. Go back 30 years. So 30 years ago, this year, I wrote a paper in the New England Journal called "The Emerging Role of Hospitalists in the American Healthcare System," which coined the term hospitalist. There was no such thing prior to that. And I remember going around and talking about this new model of a generalist taking care of hospital patients. And I got, you should be ashamed of yourself. And my father, the general practitioner, would be flipping over in his grave. And my dad called me one day. My father didn't go to college, was a big fan of doctors. He called me, he said, "Son, I was playing tennis with this guy who was a doctor." I said, "Oh yeah, Dad." He said, "He knows you, he's heard of you." I said, "Oh, that's cool." And then he said, "He hates you." So that, I'm used to this. This is like, we're conservative, we're professional, we are a legacy organization. Our organizations are, our industry, our profession is. We're going to take it slow. We have history, we have standards, and people are going to take these things at their own pace. At some point with hospitalists, you hit a tipping curve, a tipping point where you just couldn't run a hospital if you didn't have hospitalists. And, for some people, it happened early. Some people, it was after residency duty hour limits hit. It's going to happen here. It's going to, all those people who right now we're giving them license to not use the scribe. At some point, it's just going to be impossible to do the work of seeing a patient without a scribe. And you'll have people saying, "I'm going to quit," and 98% of them won't. But, that's just the nature of change management in a field like healthcare.
I mean, I honestly look forward to that. I feel like this, and again, to your point before, normally it takes 20 years to see a technology go from, hey, this works and it's in a paper to now I've got it, access to it in my clinic. We've touched a little bit on the idea of shadow IT, and I think your perspective on that is maybe the first take I've heard, where it's maybe it's a positive, right? It kind of is almost a pop-off valve for the tension of having to do enterprise level implementation and choose a given solution, but and then also it takes also the burden off maybe the education. Like, do you have to go through 10 modules to be able to use an ambient scribe? Like all the things that we typically do, and maybe that is the pop-off valve.
Yeah,
And you're,
it's an interesting question. I mean, I can tell you, I asked the folks at Epic today, where are you in terms of embedding advanced open evidence type support into the system? And the answer is they're thinking a lot about it, but they're worried about liability risk because now you're sort of getting a little closer to making diagnoses and you're now embedding them in an EHR, and therefore you've got both HIPAA and ONC regs about that. And so in some ways the system is kind of acting organically. It's not in the EHR, and that's kind of a pain because now I've got to dictate into it all the data that's already in the EHR. Why do I have to do that? But on the other hand, I'm getting value from it, and my health system is not liable for what I do with it. You could argue it's a little risky
unless you
because,
put in patient data,
right, exactly. You can argue it's a
which
little
is
risky
happening
that you're
across the
putting,
country.
you're putting HIPAA protected data into it, and so it may be that that becomes the forcing function, that the institution eventually says, people are using these damn things anyway. We better embed them in the system and make sure they go through the 37 HIPAA modules,
Yeah, right.
because otherwise we're going to get in trouble here. But for now, I think it's sort of a thousand flowers blooming and a little, and there's something actually useful about the organic use, because it would be a little premature to sort of bolt it into the system and say, we have truly figured out how to embed decision support in EHR, whereas I don't think we really have yet.
Yeah. Well, I want to say, Bob, it's just so great to have you on and have this conversation with you. I know you're a busy guy. Your book is fantastic. So everyone
Thank
out
you.
there, again, please pick it up. It's a must read, especially for those of us who are interested in this podcast or obviously interested in this topic. And
Thank you, Justin. I thought I had to be the one to do that. There we are, someone.
it's okay. We
Thanks.
came prepared.
But it's called The
Thanks.
Giant Leap. And again, Bob Wachter. But again, thank you so much for spending some
Great
time with
pleasure.
us today. And we look forward to continuing the conversation with all of you and looking forward to tracking what UCSF does as you kind of lead the field right now.
Thanks so much. Great to see you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.